Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. California law allows for the review and potential reduction of sentences, often many years after they were handed down, based on various factors such as changes in the law, good conduct, perhaps age at the time of the offense, or significant rehabilitation efforts. These changes in law might be such things as the scaling back on felony murder laws, or broader changes allowing for the prosecutor's office or the prison system itself to initiate resentencing for various reasons. Why do we do this? How did this paradigm evolve? Are these a good thing? Where do they fall short? And who gets this relief? Tonight I have a great all-star cast to help explain all this and more. Joining me tonight, Assistant Santa Clara County District Attorney David Angel. And on the defense side, Mitri Hanania, a managing attorney for the Private Defender Program of the San Mateo County Bar Association. Best of all, our most important guest would be you listeners. Have a question for our guest? Please call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, you can call us directly at 415-841-4134. 415-841-4134. And again, you're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. You want to talk criminal law? You want to talk post-conviction relief? Give me a call. I've got two great guests that are more than happy to jump into the fray. And without further ado, David Angel, Mitri Hanania, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
Who'd like to take a crack at explaining how this whole process started? When did we start the idea of looking at whether sentences that were handed down another era might be a good thing to take a look at?
I'm happy to start with that. I think it's probably important to remember there's two main streams of how this might happen. One of them is what one might think of as traditional legal venues, where there's a change in the law or there's some doctrinal reason why somebody might be entitled to relief. And we've had quite a number of statutes that have been passed in recent history.
And just because we're going to be using this word a lot, let me explain to listeners, when we use the word statute, that talks about a law that the legislature creates, that's signed by the governor, as opposed to case law, which we'll talk about separately. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay, Jeff. As lawyers, we start becoming nearly incomprehensible to anyone but ourselves. But yes, that's exactly what I meant. So what I meant to say, though, is one stream is the more traditional stream. There's a change in the law by the legislature, and that gives different claims. And sometimes it's not even a change in the law, but it's a defense attorney, and I'm sure Mitri will talk about it, discovers new evidence or new arguments that would allow someone a resentencing. But I think what you're talking about, Jeff, is where there's been a change is in a recognition that some sentences from the past may no longer be just or fair. And I really want to give a shout out to an organization called For the People, run by Hillary Blout and a group of very dedicated lawyers and others who had that insight and realized that a lot of prosecutors, both from the left and the right, would be able to look back at their careers and say, hey, you know, that sentence that I did 10 or 20, 25, I've been practicing for over 30 years, might in fact not be what we would do anymore, not accord to what we understand about justice or science. And so we should have some mechanism to revisit that and see if those sentences are still just. And that, I think, is started in that law has been expanded a number of times since it was first passed a number of years ago.
Mitri, let me ask you, why is this a good idea to go back and look at these sentences? You have people that were sentenced pretty harshly, but a long time ago, and the rest of us have moved on. Why do we go back and look?
Well, I agree with David. I think if you look at it from one point of view, the main thing is correcting injustice. And what we pride ourselves of doing in the legal system here in the United States, and especially in California, I think we pride ourselves on the fact that we try to make the legal system better. And that we do recognize that over the years, there has been missteps and injustice. And we try to figure out ways, can we correct those injustices? And we see that with the with the law that has been created in order to do so.
I've done very few of these myself. I have dabbled in them. And what I notice are the ones that tend to succeed, more often than not, are generated by the prison system itself or generated by the Office of the Prosecution that originally prosecuted the person.
Well, I'm sorry, Jeff, did I interrupt you?
I think you anticipate my next question, but go ahead.
Another bad habit of lawyers, I apologize.
We always know what the next line's going to be.
Well, what I was going to say is I think the law is designed in some ways to privilege those petitions. The ones from the prison are, in Santa Clara County, relatively rare. That they happen, but they're just not a large number. They're really ones for extraordinary conduct. They're much more common generating from the prosecutor's office, and the law itself gives a presumption that the court should recall the sentence if the prosecution requests it. Now, presumption doesn't mean that the judge has to resentence, not at all. The judge gives an independent review. But if the DA has requested it, there's a presumption that that request should result in a hearing for the individual. And in some ways, I think that makes sense. I'm not saying that should be the only way, but if the elected district attorney who is doing his or her best to reflect the values of that community, and I know we always prioritize public safety over everything else, if we believe that a sentence is no longer just and that a person no longer presents a risk to the public, then that just carries a weight that is a little different than obviously the person who's incarcerated might always feel that he is a good risk, but there's no one really vetting that. So I think that's why more of them, and certainly the successful ones, are coming out of the prosecutor's office or the prison itself.
Is there presently a vehicle for the defense to bring matters to the court and have the court set aside a sentence and resentence somebody?
I could probably talk on that. They're under the same case law, and just for, you know, anybody who's interested in reading it, it's Penal Code Section 1172.1. Individual can submit to the court a petition to request resentencing. And then it's totally up to the court to make that decision on whether or not to even read the petition. I mean, a court can disregard it and not even look at it, or take a look and decide, yes, I think, you know, over time, something, you know, the person may have submitted to the court, you know, letters of support and certificates of showing completion of college type credit classes or work program that they did in prison, staying disciplinary free and so on. And a judge might say, you know, I'm going to take a look at this and I'm going to put this on the calendar and I'm going to appoint counsel and I'm going to have the district attorney take a look and I want to listen to everybody and let's see if this person warrants resentencing. And that is a potential option for an individual to do.
Certainly in our county, I think we try to get to, well, let me rephrase. We try to first see if we can view these collaboratively. So if the court brings this to our attention because the defense attorney filed it, or if we were filing it ourselves, we see if we can come to an agreement. And often we can. So really the only thing the courts should be, I mean, they have to hear them all because it's their independent judgment, of course, and I don't mean to ever suggest it's not. But the ones they're really going to have to spend more time on are the actual contested ones where there's no meeting of the minds. I think the law would, you're really not going to meet the will of the people if you try to contest every single one of these. There should be some effort to come to an agreement on many of them.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you, David. I wish in San Mateo County, the district attorney's office did take that kind of position where, and the courts, where these were more, the 1172.1s were something that we can all take a look at and bring before the court, or at least the court take a look at them. But that hasn't happened, and it's unfortunate.
Jeff, I don't know if it'd be helpful, and Mitri, but let me, it might be helpful for people to understand at least what a basic prosecutor-initiated resentencing might look like. And a typical one that we began with is someone who I would say their sentence was probably just and fair at the time of the sentence. And a classic case was, say, somebody who is at the time of their conviction. They had been convicted of a residential burglary. So they had broken into someone else's house to steal. And they had three strikes because they had done it over and over and over again. And they had failed the treatment over and over again. And now they got sentenced under the three strikes law. The problem is, you might be a really long time, depending on how that's charged, before that person can even have a shot at parole. Well, what happens when it comes to your attention as a prosecutor or as a community? That was true of this person 25 years ago, but now it's a man in his 50s, and he's been clean and sober for 2 decades, and he has a perfect disciplinary history. He's just not the same person anymore, and he's no longer struggling with his substance abuse. Does it make sense to say, no, you got to run the clock in prison for maybe another decade before you can even ask for parole? When we all know that he would get parole if he had the legal right to be there. So I think it's important to understand that that's what a lot of these cases are. People who really are no longer a threat to the community, but by sequestering them in prison from the community, you don't allow them to have a relationship with their kids. You don't allow them to have a relationship with their families. You don't allow the community to accept them back in. Every incarceration is, I'm a prosecutor. I believe you have to have that. But we shouldn't forget that that causes a lot of damage to the people left behind. And so that's why I think it's very important in these cases to revisit it.
Completely agree.
Even before sentencing, some sources surprise you with the level of insight. A very conservative San Mateo County judge once commented at a sentencing about milestones that we have in our life at different ages and how he saw this person had changed in the couple of years that his case was pending because he crossed over his 40th and he could see a difference in him and took a chance. And he was right. And this is a very unlikely source, a very conservative judge. Maybe off air I'll share the name. But he was also quite right. There are times in our lives when we do a reset, and that should be taken into account sometimes in sentencing.
Well, and there's another related area to that. In addition to drug addiction, which we know is such a strong driver of many people involved in crime, earlier I'd said there can be changes in science. And one of the things I was referring to is mental health and drugs. I recently had, I mean, pharmaceutical drugs for mental illness. I recently had a case with a person who had committed truly terrible crimes and was in prison, acting exactly how do you expect someone like to act, committing, prison violation after prison violation. And then suddenly, there was not a single other violation, not one. And in fact, the person became a model prisoner. And when we looked into it, we discovered that that was about 6 months after they found the correct medication, which probably didn't even exist when he went in, put him on it. And then the voices, the impulses, the mental illness that was driving it ended, and he became truly a completely different person. Well, in the same way you're saying with Jeff with milestones, well, that's an important milestone that this soul had regained his mental health. And a just criminal justice system has to be able to at least look at that and try to balance the equities.
A similar factor that I would hope your office is considering is youth. Now we have science that tells us how far along in life before people's brains are really developed, and their decision-making in the life of people under 25 is often quite flawed by the standards of what they would be when they're 30, 35, 40 years old.
That's one of the factors that the law itself says should be taken into account. It's kind of twofold. Age at the time they committed the offense, is it under 25? And their age now, are they over an age where people are likely to commit new crimes? Now, of course, that's case specific. It's not like a checklist, but they are two factors that have to be considered.
So I have a family member in the prison system who's raising this question and is asking, am I eligible for prosecutor-initiated resentencing? What would be the answer to that?
I think it's going to, well, first of all, the short but not terribly helpful answer is yes. You know, everyone is eligible for it. A more robust answer would say, well, it's going to depend a lot on the county, and meaning the philosophy of the elected district attorney. I know what we like to look at is, has the person served a substantial amount of their term? Do they have a substantial amount yet to go? In other words, if they're eligible for parole within a year, like, there may not be a lot of reason to put all the resources into figuring out a resentencing. Have they had a excellent or superlative prison history? And how is their sentence, have sentencing practices changed such that if they committed the same crime now, they would have received a lesser sentence anyway? And then one thing we haven't really talked about yet, but I feel compelled to mention is, especially if you're talking about crimes where there are victims, crimes of violence, remember, this can be extraordinarily re-traumatized. We have something they thought was done, brought back. It can cause extreme pain and disruption. And so I think that also has to be very much balanced in all of this. If we're talking about justice and equities, how do we balance all of those things? So in terms of the person, maybe looking at all those factors, and then honestly, they probably need the help of Mitri or someone like you, Jeff, to help them assess those, because that's not something that one can readily do without specialized knowledge, to be honest.
Mitri, do you find that in San Mateo they are looking at the same factors pretty much?
They are. I mean, I will say this. The DA's office in San Mateo County will look at a request under 1172.1 that we're talking about here, a request for resentencing, and they're going to look at those factors. I do think the primary factor that I've heard from the district attorney's office is they want to ensure that the victim in the case has a say as to what's going to occur here, and they're sensitive to what a victim might have to say in terms of the resentencing. The other factors would be is, it's kind of interesting, the amount of time that's left. I've seen it where they may be more open to somebody who has, you know, 2 years left on their time and may agree to the resentencing if it's, you know, a couple years left, because they're going to get out in a couple years. And so they may think about doing the resentencing in that regard. So that's probably the best that I can say. Me personally, because I do believe in rehabilitation, I do see, you know, older inmates who have really, you know, changed from who they were when they were in their 20s, when they were in their teens. Their mind is more developed. They're more patient. They're more knowledgeable. They still have even, you know, family support, community support, and so on. You know, I can see those folks doing well being released from prison, even with more time hanging over their head, as opposed to just having 2 years left. Because, you know, the main thing for all of this is this, you know, as human beings, we can all say when we look back 20 years, we were very different in mindset than we are today. And, you know, human beings through transformation, and then it could be either religious transformation, it can be through education, it can also be through loved ones. I mean, I have folks where their wives have remained with them for 20 plus years, and they have adult children, and they're all so supportive of their loved one incarcerated. And that, you know, I think should give a person a chance for everybody to look at for resentencing. It's humane. And that's what we do in this system, is try to be humane and undo that injustice that we've seen in the past.
There's one other factor that we all take for granted. We work in the criminal justice system, and it goes without saying, so we skip over it and don't even say it out loud too much of the time. But one of the main factors has got to be public safety. And we want to do right by the person who was sentenced. We also want to do right by the people that he's going to be released to, or she's going to be released to. And a wise judge once told me we could keep doing things the way we've been doing them and have the same results. Sometimes you have to look a little differently. And after all, from my own perspective now, the key is to not necessarily to punish somebody the most severely for breaking in the house next door. We want to make sure they don't break in the house next door. And sometimes that's rehabilitating somebody where nobody's taken the time to do that or the effort to do that.
Yeah, Jeff, I think that's true. I think that's true.
One of the things we talked about is some of the different counties and different standards. And we didn't say you have to go back to the county where you were sentenced. It's, you don't have a choice. How do I know who prosecuted my case or my loved one's case?
Well, you know, I think a guidepost is that's almost invariably going to be the county where the trial happened or where the crime happened. And, you know, for a loved one, sometimes it's hard to, you know, or just take an interest. It might be hard to find that out, but that's almost invariably going to be the right district attorney's office to approach, is the county where the trial or crime happened.
Right. And you can also ask there in prison, there is a counselor, and the counselor does have access to either the abstract of judgment, which shows the commitment county, and there is also a legal summary that every inmate has that shows the sentence, the charges, the county, and so on.
It's a good point because I have gotten requests, and my opinion will amount to all of a hill of beans. I mean, I have no authority over it, I have no influence over it, and I'll just tell them to reapply to the correct county because it just that's the way it works in California. There's no overall authority from one county over the other.
And for those of our listeners who do have a family member, a close friend, a loved one in the Department of Corrections, you can go to their website at cdcr.ca.gov, search the population, find your loved one, and it will tell you not only where they're housed, but it will also list the committing county.
That's
And
right.
that will give you a heads up.
That is correct.
I'd rather be familiar with cases that were originally prosecuted by the Department of Justice, that is through the Attorney General's office. They may have a different vehicle to find out where to go.
Yeah, I'm not really. You mean the State Department of Justice?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, Santa Clara County is such a big county. We really, I can't think of the last time we had the DOJ prosecute a case for us. So I don't know. I think that would generally be smaller counties where they had someone on a circuit. But I don't know, Mitri, do you know if there's other ways?
Well, if I understood right, Jeff, are you talking about when the attorney general takes over instead of the elected local prosecutor?
Yes, in those rare cases, there is a vehicle. you or your authorized designee may complete an electronic application, which you can get from the Department of Justice website, or you can get from the Department of Justice Post-Conviction Unit in Sacramento, California. The last thing I wanted to talk about this half hour are those cases where somebody goes to directly to the Department of, I'm sorry, directly to CDCR, that's the state prison system. The prison system is considering it. Who's eligible for referral, and what factors have you seen where they list them, how well they're doing, or the reasons that they're behind it or not?
You mean when the Department of Corrections recommends someone recall, ask the judge to recall a sentence? Yeah, it's very rare. It can be for any crime, even the very, very serious crimes. CDCR is not going to look at why they're in prison, but they're going to look at their behavior while in prison. I think it's important to remember, they rarely do this. Last time I looked at percentage, it was like under 5%. It might even be under 3%. It's very rare for an inmate to have that level of achievement, but it does happen. Those will be sent to the court. Now, it used to be, I think, that they just like, I can't remember which of you mentioned earlier. It used to be that the judges may or may not even do anything, right? They might, and I think a while back, nobody really even understood what these were and why were they doing it. And I think judges felt very isolated. Now that we have these laws that have been passed and it has become understood that, you know, justice doesn't end at the end of the trial, it's an ongoing process, I think courts are much more aware. And when that happens, they will refer it to the appropriate defense attorney. They'll refer it to the district attorney so that we can all weigh in. And I can't think in recent history of any CDCR recommended recall that all of the parties haven't agreed that they have earned the right to that recall.
And Mitri, when you get a request, one of your attorneys is assigned, what types of things should that attorney be doing to get ready?
Well, my opinion, it would be one is to accumulate as much of the records as possible from CDCR, then get an investigator to go and interview family members, people who are friends and support for this individual to create a viable release plan. Because I think that's important for judges to see is what is this individual going to do when released? Is there support? Is there a plan in place? Does this person have thought it out? Are they going to be working? Where are they going to be living? Who are they going to be living with? And so on. You would also want to get a social worker to do a social history workup of the individual, of what caused this individual to be in the predicament they are, and then what transformations occurred in prison and so on. And I think that's also important to have. And so you have this holistic, you know, defense here of individuals working together as a team to show what got the person here, how do they transform, and then what is in place when they get released. I think you put that all together, that makes a very efficient way of presenting a case to both the district attorney's office and the court.
And what you're showing is the likelihood that this person is going to succeed. And the corollary to that, can I let this person out? And will everyone still remain safe? You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 San Francisco Bay Area. And we'll be back right after this.
There's this pack of lesbians and they're trying to form a neighborhood, an intentional neighborhood called Woman Town. I thought, what?
Yeah! Yeah!
Join us for more true stories told live. Friendly neighbors, midnight movies, and nun surveillance. Stories of belonging. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
The Moth Radio Hour will be tonight at 7 o'clock on 91.7 FM KALW San Francisco, followed by 8 o'clock's One Way Possible. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. We now return to Your Legal Rights with host Jeff Hayden on Local Public Radio, 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, and online at KALW.org.
So tonight we're taking a visit into criminal law and talking about resentencing. That's examining the sentencing of people that have been oftentimes incarcerated for quite some time. We're back next week and looking at our year-end tax broadcast. 2 weeks out, we're going to be talking landlord-tenant law. But let's circle back and go back to talking about resentencings. We talked a little bit about the types of factors that the prosecutor's going to want to look at, the court's going to want to look at. Let's talk about some of the different types of resentencing laws. By way of example, we had Proposition 36, which has been used many, many times, that same numbering in the criminal justice system, for reasons I can't figure. It seems that there's always a major milestone, and they call it Proposition 36. But in 2012, we had a Proposition 36 that allowed for resentencing of those serving a life sentence under the three strikes law for an offense that may not be a serious felony. I'll ask both of you, are these showing up very often in the justice system that you've seen?
Mitra, you want to start with that in San Mateo, and then I can tell you about Santa Clara.
Are we talking about the Prop 36, Jeff, from in relation to three strikes?
The second of the three Prop 36s that have passed in the last decade or decade and a half. In 2012, that's the one that said that only a serious or violent felony can get you a 25 to life sentence. Otherwise, they treat it as a second strike. Are there resentencings pursuant to Proposition 36? And do we see those often where somebody may have received the 25 to life for not registering or something of that nature?
So this was the precursor to what we're seeing now. So in San Mateo County, we did have a flow of Prop 36 cases that came in, and individuals did get resentenced under Prop 36. But there was also this population group who were lifers. There were three strikers, individuals who their third strike may have been a robbery or a residential burglary and so on, that were ineligible to be resentenced. And I think the legislator took a look at that group and said, what can we do for the individual who wouldn't maybe have gotten a life sentence today, an individual who's, you know, age 50 or older and has a disciplinary free prison record, maybe some health related conditions and so on? Can we figure out a way? And I think that's what the catalyst we see now under the law that came out in relation to prosecutor or CDCR initiated referrals, and even the resentencings where individuals had 1 year prison priors and those got resentenced also. And so that's my take of it from here in San Mateo County.
I think that's right. There's multiple mechanisms. There's one you mentioned, Jeff, the three strike cases, and of course, the beginning, we had quite a few of those. I do want to make sure everyone remembers, if you're not working in the field, all of these require a public safety review by the court. So a court can say, irrespective of this new law, if I find this person is an unreasonable danger to the public, I'm not granting them the release. So that, I think that's essential. Like, we just, I don't think we should ever release people if who have been received such a long sentence justly under the law. No one should be released if they can't demonstrate that they are no longer a danger to the public. That having been said, there are many people who, for whom that's true. They're just not a danger to the public anymore. And Mitri pointed, it's not just Prop 36, which is about revisiting some of the three strike cases. There is also a law targeting what was called prison priors. These were enhancements, meaning somebody could be sentenced. The judge could add a year or even not add the year based on them having been to prison previously within a certain period of time. And that is enough to recall the sentence. The judge would give them a new sentencing hearing as a matter of law. But again, that doesn't mean someone is going to be released. It means the judge can and should consider public safety and all the other equities before resentencing them. A third common one were the so-called Prop 8 priors. This gets a little technical, but it was just another enhancement that can be brought back. And then there were numerous others. There's been changes in the felony murder law. There's been changes in how gang enhancements work. All of these can go back. And I will suggest that that may suggest a problem, is that's a lot of work. It's a huge burden on the prosecutor's office, a huge burden on the defense bar and the court. That burden isn't a bad thing, but as we know, in times of budget cuts, you can have real backlogs that can prevent even hearing any of these cases until you can get people assigned to do them. And a lot of these can be very, as I said, traumatizing for people who want to believe there's some finality. So you're always balancing these goals.
And then, of course, there are the changes that made most simple drug possession misdemeanor. We've scaled back about from that in the last couple of years.
Yes. I mean, certainly in Santa Clara County, there were so few people who were actually – that had less impact than one might think. Arguably for the same reason the latest Prop 36 had less impact than one might think, because there were so few people who were going to prison for simple drug cases that when they changed it so you're no longer eligible for prison based on that, I don't know, Mitri, what you found, but the most of the people who on the surface seemed to be eligible for that were in fact, yes, it was a simple drug case, but it was also an armed robbery. Or, you know, there were other counts that were really what were telling that story.
Yeah, I do see, you know, that's what I've seen over the years. But I've also seen, you know, there were times under the three strikes law where, you know, a petty theft with a prior got you a life sentence. I mean, it just, the pendulum had swung way too far right at one point where I think we paid the price in California. We have created a huge prison system that the overcrowding was at a point where a federal judge had to step in and an order that, you know, the prison population had to be reduced, and the governor and the legislator at the time had to figure out ways to reduce it and so on. And I think also people started looking at drug addiction in a different way and understanding that, you know, incarcerating somebody isn't the answer for addiction. It's the answer for addiction really is putting in resources where a person can get the right kind of treatment. And now with mental health in combination with a drug addiction, you have a dual diagnosis issue where you do need very specialized type treatment in order to help an individual combat that.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we're revisiting resentencing laws in California. That is, reviewing sentences that were handed down often years ago based on changes in the way we approach criminal justice, the way that people have conducted themselves since time then, or maybe changes in law. Of course, you're welcome to join us at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. 4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can call us with any question you want to talk about resentencing, whether it's right, whether it can help someone you know. You could talk about criminal law in general. You're not limited to the moment we may be in our conversation. Let's talk a little bit about eligibility and the process. We talked about a few of these laws that have revisited sentencing. Is it available to everyone, or are there some people that are excluded?
Well, there's multiple different laws. So some of them you're excluded from. So, for example, I mean, to take what probably sounds obvious, but there's a change in the felony murder rule, which is probably a subject in and of itself. But suffice to say, if you were not convicted of a murder, you're not going to be able to get relief under the felony murder rule. There were other laws that changed gang enhancements. Well, the same thing. However, for prison-initiated and prosecutor-initiated recall, or for that matter, judicial-initiated recall, which I think Mitri had referred to earlier, those are not limited by the category of the crime. But in general, for those, you know, for the ones I mentioned earlier, in some ways, all the defense attorney has to do is show that the person is eligible, you know, under the kind of the checklist of the rules of the law. And it doesn't even matter whether it's fair or not fair, provided they can show they're not a danger to the public. If they're eligible, they're eligible. For the ones that are broader, where a greater range of people are eligible, they're going to have to make an equitable argument, meaning they're going to have to show, why is this fair? Why is this just? This happens now. But that's a good thing. That's what our system should always be focused on. So those are different sorts of cases, but in some ways they're the most powerful and the most interesting.
Mitri, talk a little bit about the process of filing a petition.
Yes. So what an individual can do is they can file their own. Well, there's two routes. One is they could create a packet and submit that packet directly to the district attorney's office that where they were sentenced out of. And the district attorney can take a look at the packet. And it's basically a request letter that you're requesting that the district attorney's office look at this. And if they feel that, they'd like to take a look at this, or there should be resentencing here, then they will do a district attorney initiated resentencing, for example. The other would be is if one of the resentencing statute applies, you can then either fill out a form, and sometimes a lot of times in the prisons, they have these, forms that has been created where you check boxes, you write your name, your case number, you check the boxes, you write down some information and so on. And then you mail it to the court, and you also mail it to the district attorney's office and the public defender's office of that county. And that is another way. So you mail it to the clerk's office at the courthouse. The clerk takes a look at it. They stamp it as either filed or received. And then it goes through the process of from there of trying to get on calendar and having the parties appear and so on. Now, for a loved one who is incarcerated, they may not be able to appear right away because there's no immediate order to transfer them to the local jail or to get an order for them to appear by Zoom, but they can make that request and eventually they can appear in their case either in person by being transferred to the local jail or via Zoom. And usually in our county, majority of our clients do rather prefer appearing via Zoom at first, so they don't lose their housing. It can be very restrictive housing in a local jail compared to a state prison. They can also then appear in person at time of their hearing or not. Just depends on the individual.
You mentioned a hearing. How are these hearings conducted?
They're conducted before a judge. The judge determines the validity of the motion or petition before the court, and then determines whether or not to grant the relief being requested.
So it's a two-step process, if I understand you right.
Right. That is correct. And there could be witnesses that are brought on by both sides. The district attorney can put on witnesses, including the victim in the case, if the case involved a victim. And the defense can put on family members, people of support, things like that.
Is the process much the same in Santa Clara?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, again, it's going to depend a little bit about what's the legal vehicle that, I mean, if they're coming in on a technical issue, which could be very important, it could be, I was not the actual killer. I aided and abetted, and so I'm entitled to different relief now than at the time of my sentence. That's going to be a very technical hearing, and the witnesses are probably going to be witnesses to the crime. But if it's the sort of resentencing that we've discussed, which is more based on the fullness of the picture of what's just or not, we're always going to seek input from the victims. They have a right to be present. They have a right to express their views, and the court should take that into account. But the statute also, meaning the law, also wants the court to take into account things like whether they were a victim of human trafficking, whether meaning the defendant. Was the defendant a victim of human trafficking? Was the defendant, the inmate, a victim of sexual abuse and so on? Those are all things to be taken into account. And while it would be rare to have a live witness, a court is definitely going to get documents, records as evidence about their prison record and whether they have any violence while they're in prison and whether they've participated in rehabilitative programming and so on. All that will go in front of the judge, and then the judge will make a decision. Are they safe? Is it to the release of the public? If the answer is no, that's the end. There's no hearing. If the answer is yes, there's a hearing. And then the judge decides if a resentencing is in the interest of justice, which, by the way, does not necessarily mean the person is immediately released. Sometimes it's about reducing the sentence because the court feels or the prosecutor feels, hey, they should have an opportunity to make their case in front of the parole board. But because of all of these positive things they've done, they should have that opportunity sooner than they would otherwise be eligible for. And that can be very meaningful for people to have that opportunity.
It might be as simple as the Menendez case that we've all watched on TV for many years, where they were given life without parole originally. Now they're eligible for parole. That doesn't necessarily mean they get it, but they have a chance to be heard.
Exactly.
I know there was a time when the judges used to cast a very wide net and not look to listen to these cases, but rather would just strike them, dismiss them en masse. Has that changed? Do the judges now have greater authority to reconsider sentences and look at more factors than they once did?
Well, absolutely. I think it's both a legal change. Certainly, the all these new laws that were passed will bring things in front of a judge. I mean, that's a huge change. But also, these laws contain within it factors a court should consider, which includes many of the things we mentioned before, but not least of which is this, or one of them would be, say, childhood trauma or mental illness or other factors. And again, that doesn't give someone an automatic out. It just means it's something to be considered. But perhaps the biggest thing is a cultural change. I know in our county, my DA, I'm very lucky to work for, Jeff Rosen, he was one who helped, in fact, draft the initial law for initiated recall. He has spoken very passionately about his belief in the potential for rehabilitation and has been a real leader. Well, that, you know, that validates others who might feel that way. A judge who might otherwise feel on their own and vulnerable knows that while we might not always agree, we agree in principle that these cases should be heard and that that it's justice to look on the situation now, not just what happened at the day of the trial.
We've been talking California since the beginning of the show, but we have a call from Pete in Florida. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Good. Hi. Yes. You got me thinking. I remembered something that happened back in the 1980s. There was a story on the news. Well, look at it this way. You can approach it. You got this upright citizen. I remember he was an elevator repairman. He had a family. He had a house, like head of the local Cub Scouts or Boy Scouts, whatever. And one day they arrested him because, in fact, and I don't know if this is DNA or whatever, he had murdered someone decades earlier, and he was a fugitive. But nobody knew it. He was basically an upright citizen. And I remember talking to a friend of mine. He's like, "Well, what should be done with him?" And he said, "This old guy. What do you? You put him in jail?" And I remember my friend said, "He said they should consider that he rehabilitated himself." You know, and anyway, so that's a real thing. You know, that a fugitive can actually, in the process of, keeping the law, keeping away from the law, leads a completely upright life. So what do you think about that?
I'll speak as a prosecutor. That's very difficult. You know, there's always going to be challenging cases. I think when you murder someone, you have to be held accountable. And no matter how kind you may have been afterwards, you still took a human life. And even if we somehow knew that they would never reoffend again, which of course you can never know, the scope of the suffering and that they've caused that spills for generations in many cases, I think people have to take accountability for it. Now, what the particular sentence should be after that, that's a complicated issue for the judge. But I don't think good behavior after the fact can change the guilt and accountability that's necessary, particularly for violent crimes that leave real victims.
All right. I was thinking the same thing, that maybe if he's an upright citizen, he's got a house, make him sell his house and you compensate the victims with the money, but don't take it out of his flesh. You know what I'm saying? There's no rehabilitation to be done, but maybe there's money and compensation in that way.
You're actually touching on a bigger question, which we won't have time to get into tonight. But the larger question, Peter, is you're raising is at what point do we look at deterrence as opposed to retribution? And what signal does it send when you give somebody a break because he shows that he's no longer a danger to public safety, but on the other hand, you're letting a murderer go free? And
right.
These are questions that are really above our pay grade, at least in terms of tonight's show. But it's always a pleasure, and I really appreciate talking with you, Peter. Have a great night, and thank you for calling us. We're really out of time, and I did want to give each of my guests a chance for any final remarks. So I'll start with you, David. Take about 2 minutes.
Sure. Well, thank you. It's been a very interesting conversation. And thank you, Mitri. Thank you, Jeff. Look, as I said at the beginning, I feel very lucky because DA Jeff Rosen has really been a visionary here and a leader here. And that sets a tone, not just for the whole office. And it has collateral effects for the type of prosecutors who want to work for us. How you look at all these cases is when you recognize that people are complicated. All of these things are complicated. And I know one value that he impressed upon me and all of us is if you think you can quickly judge the right or wrong of any of these complicated, critical crimes, you're wrong. They're always very complicated. There's a lot of factors to take into account. That having been said, people need to be held accountable. We need to protect the public. But there comes a time when we have to revisit these cases to look at them through a contemporary lens and always be willing to acknowledge we might have made a mistake, we might have been wrong, or maybe facts have changed. And that means we can address them now. So I think these are really powerful laws, and I just feel grateful to work for a district attorney that's championed that.
Thank you. And Mitri, take about 2 minutes.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, David. And Santa Clara County is very fortunate to have a ADA like yourself, David, in your county. I will say this. All of my career, the 25 plus years of doing defense work, it's because my sincere belief that human beings can rehabilitate if you give them a chance. They can better their lives. And so the resentencing process has to be looked at through the lens of, does this individual show both rehabilitation, insight to what was done, and a lack of a belief that the person is going to recommit a new crime? Because we all know it. That's the last thing anybody would like to see, is a person to go out, get out of prison, and then go hurt somebody else. And that is not the goal of this process. The goal is to bring home individuals who should not be incarcerated any further for the various reasons we spoke about tonight. And I also thank, and we're very blessed in San Mateo County to have Lisa McGuire, who's head of the Private Defender Program, for the foresight and her determination to change the way the defense bar here approaches these cases and all cases in a holistic defense model. And she's done a wonderful job bringing in a management team who are bringing in those changes here. So that I think she needs to be applauded for all the hard work she's done. Yeah.
And I have to add to that, both of you, each of you, not just for joining us tonight, but your individualized efforts in your respective arenas have not gone unnoticed. And that's why you had this invitation tonight. We appreciate the work you do, not just being here, but the day-to-day work that we all do in the system. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we've been talking about resentencing. That is where the courts, where the prosecutors, where the prison system, where we're taking a step back and examining sentences that may have taken place in another era when things were different. Our guests tonight have been from the Santa Clara County District Attorney's Office, Assistant District Attorney David Angel, and from the Private Defender Program of the San Mateo County Bar Association, Managing Attorney Mitri Hanania. My thanks to both of you for joining us tonight. It's nearing the end of the year, and you want to know what to do to minimize that tax burden. Join us next week, where we have our year-end tax broadcast. The week following, we're looking again at landlord-tenant law. Best of all, we'll take your calls and answer your questions. Once again, a big thanks to tonight's guests and to all of you for joining us. On behalf of Your Legal Rights, a big thanks to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Damian D. Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, be safe, and zealously guard your legal rights.